you think life is simpler as time evolves? For some, it can be more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Tucker Allen, providing intelligent answers for those thinking about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. This week, we want to return to a topic that we try to get back to periodically because it's of huge importance to you, our audience, to people who are older than 65. So we want to talk to you about how do you plan for the cost of long-term care? That's a big deal. Now, I get a big yawn when this subject comes up and I'm talking to clients who are under 60.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that they don't understand there's a chance that they would need long-term care and that it might not be covered by their insurance, but that they just figure it's so far off in the future and I may be able to dodge that bullet anyway. Well, it's true that most of us, we don't know that we're going to need it. Some of the people listening do know. I mean, you may have a diagnosis. I mean,
right.
If you have a diagnosis of certain things like Parkinson's or MS, you know that there's a higher chance that in the future you may need long-term care and that generally insurance is not going to provide this. So how do you pay for this without having to deplete all your assets? And that's what the conversation is about. For somebody who expects to reach a situation where they've got to be in a skilled care facility, for example, or even an assisted living facility in some cases, how do I pay for this without having to first spend everything that I have saved over the course of my life?
Protecting your assets.
Yeah. And many people, their primary concern is protecting it for their loved ones.
Yeah.
For people that their children, their perhaps surviving spouse, et cetera. So it turns out that there is a way for most people, for the vast majority, I would argue, to have some benefit from this planning that allows them to have that paid for by qualifying for Medicaid. And Medicaid is not something where you have to be real poor in the sense that many of us understand that word. But in fact, it's a program that's designed to allow you to qualify in a way to where you can plan for your assets. So this isn't trying to do something that is undermining the system, that's exploiting holes in the system. It's like the tax code. What you think are loopholes or oversights are almost without exception intended deductions and exemptions and exclusions, meaning it's part of the plan. It was intended that people would have these deductions or these opportunities because the legislators or others concluded it's in our interest as an economy or a society to allow people, to encourage people to do certain things. Well, the Medicaid rules are written the same way, and there are opportunities for you to qualify if you have assets, but you have to do it very carefully. You have to have an expert. I think it's safe to say that of all the many things that you do in the legal field. A lawyer will always tell you need to have a lawyer. But in this area, I would say especially you need to have a lawyer because it's fraught with complications. It's the reason most lawyers don't do Medicaid planning, quote unquote, or what's called elder law. When you hear the phrase elder law used, that includes trusts and it includes wills and standard things that you might think about, powers of attorney. But in large part, that practice area tends to be dominated by planning for the costs of long-term care because the world we live in, that we have, the good news is we have technology and we have pharmacology and we have all these sophisticated techniques to allow us to live longer than we otherwise would. But the bad news is they cost money. And it's difficult to be able to pay for those things without depleting everything you own. And so
things you work so hard for all your lives.
That's right. So we wanted to take some time this week and talk a little bit about Medicaid planning. And it's not for everyone, but we think that our audience should know about it and decide to what extent might it apply to them. And appropriately enough, we have back on the show Teresa Yao, who is with Tucker Allen.
Hi.
She's an attorney with Tucker Allen, and she's knowledgeable in this area. She practices in the area of estate planning and elder law. And so we want to familiarize you with these topics. And many of you will decide if it's something that you need to pursue or not.
And it's always good to have you here, Teresa. You know, if we could start off, you know, can you explain the laws involving Medicaid? And, you know, without going into too much detail, but specifically, the recipient is required to pay back expenses paid by Medicaid. Is that correct?
Yeah. So for the expenses paid by Medicaid, that's what we kind of call Medicaid estate recovery. And that's more the notion about if a Medicaid recipient is receiving the benefits of Medicaid after they pass away, Medicaid is able to lay claims against their estate to recover for the benefits that they provided while the person was still alive.
So taking their home, correct?
Having liens on the home, so making sure that the state can be paid if the home is sold later on. So
yeah, there was a time when this was blown off to a great extent, mm-hmm. meaning that many states didn't, in fact, though they were required, as a matter of fact, they've been required since this legislation was first passed, I think around 1970, they were required to offer some sort of collection service, mm-hmm. and many simply didn't do it. Whereas in recent decades, especially over the past decade, there's been this big push on the part of CMS, which is the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which dominates or administrates largely the Medicaid and Medicare programs. They've taken the position that if a state fails to have in place and to vigorously pursue repayment for the funds that are provided by Medicaid during the course of somebody's life, if they fail to pursue that, then that state will be terminated in terms of having funds matched for repayment, which is the system right now is a matching of funds between state and federal.
Mm-hmm. And there are some exceptions, though, to this. Say if the Medicaid recipient dies, but there was that adult child that lived with them who provided care for that person.
Yeah, so in terms of for the home, for the Medicaid liens and estate recovery, the exceptions are, for example, if you received the benefits when you were 55 or younger, then they wouldn't be allowed to recover from that estate, or if you have a surviving spouse. So Medicaid wouldn't merely be able to recover for you until after your spouse dies, but once your spouse dies, then they can lay those claims against your estate to recover those costs.
So if you were receiving services mm-hmm. 55 or younger, then Medicaid can't recover?
So if you're 55 and younger and you were receiving those benefits and then you pass away, then they can't recover against your estate. However, for most long-term care, most people, unless you are deemed disabled by Social Security, for older adults that end up requiring long-term care like nursing home care, assisted living care, home and community-based services, those are still benefits that, like, most people, I guess, are over age 55 and over. So in terms of the estate recovery, that's still a concern for most Medicaid recipients.
Yeah, there are esoteric rules, and that's what makes this so complicated. But many people are under the impression that because sometimes a home is referred to as an exempt asset, quote unquote, they interpret that word to mean that they will be able to pass their house on to their loved ones, et cetera. But as Teresa was suggesting, I mean, it's not the case. Really, there's a duty for the state, for the attorney general, to collect after the person's death on that house. And they can even do it when the person, the recipient of the long-term care services, moves out. If there's not mm-hmm. a spouse there at the time and there's no prospect that this person's going to be moving back into their home, which often there isn't, then technically that home can be sold at that time.
Yeah. They can take action.
Yeah.
They can take action at that time. Thankfully, often they don't at that point. They do later after the death of mm-hmm. the recipient. But it is something that many people are not aware of that fact, and they think that their house is somehow protected. And there are a few esoteric rules that we don't have time with this format to get into. But again, it's the reason that you definitely need to see an attorney who practices in this area in order to be able to plan for qualifying for long-term care, because it is a very complicated area. It's like mm-hmm. if you want planning for taxes, almost without exception, you go to a tax lawyer. That's not true of every practice area, but some areas are just notoriously technical and difficult. And tax law is one of those areas, and I would argue so is planning related to long-term care.
Right.
Yeah. And I just want to touch on the house being an exempt resource. I think that is oftentimes confused with, well, if it's exempt, then does that mean there's no lien on it? Well, it's only exempt in cases where you're applying for Medicaid. So when you apply for Medicaid, there's certain resources that they're saying, okay, you get to protect that for the sake of eligibility. But that doesn't mean that the house, it might be exempt for the sake of application, but the house is still up for the Medicaid lien and estate recovery.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And there, and you mentioned, for example, one of the rules where you've had a child who has lived there and has allowed you to avoid going into long-term care.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And where those criteria are met and a couple other prongs, mm-hmm. then it's true that you may be able to avoid having the house sold under those conditions. It also, there's another archaic rule regarding a sibling that might have lived with you in the house for purposes of taking care of you,
caregiver.
And their name has been added to the deed. They may be protected regarding that half of the house. It may not be regarded as an improper transfer, in other words. So these things that we're talking about now are just examples of the sort of rules that require somebody who practices in this area to be able to help you. So this is not a pitch for Tucker Allen, per se. The nature of this show is really to give a lot of useful information. But Tucker Allen does this, and if somebody doesn't go to Tucker Allen, they should be sure they go to a firm that focuses on practicing in this area specifically. There are just so many federal and state federal bureaucratic rules, I would say.
Oh, yeah, very complicated. So you want somebody that is well-versed in this area, absolutely. Now, how long does Medicaid or the state have to file a claim against an estate?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So in Missouri, Medicaid can file claims against any probate estate after a person passes away. Normally in probate, there's that 6-month creditor period where you can come forward and lay claims against an estate, or even like a 1-year statute of limitations to file a claim. But with Medicaid, actually, they don't have to follow those rules. So they can file the claim outside of those time limits. So
the federal government has prerogatives that
they get to be paid back.
Yeah, they're considered a priority claimant, and so they're protected in ways that standard creditors are not. You know, one thing though that I want to kind of give people a feel for what are some of the obstacles to their normally qualifying for Medicaid, even if they have some assets. Mm-hmm. And the general rules for Medicaid require that you be broke. I mean, it varies from state to state. Some will allow you to have $1,000, $1,500. Some will allow you to have $1,000 in permanent life insurance, meaning cash value and life insurance. Mm-hmm. Missouri is in the $2,000 range, I think. Is that right, Teresa?
For resources, for individuals, is $4,000, but that's still like, that's all your assets, right? If $4,000 more, then you're not eligible.
So when you look at these rules, in whatever state you're in, I mean, it becomes clear that you have to be broke, because the people we're talking to are not concerned about saving $2,000, $3,000, or $4,000. They're concerned about maybe they, over the course of their working careers, including their house, they have $500,000 in value. That's not uncommon at all today, or more.
Right.
So people are wondering, is there a way that I can save this money and still be able to pay for this long-term care? And that becomes the discussion. So some would say, well, gee, can I not just give the property away? I'm going to solve this problem by giving the property to my daughter or son. Well, there's lots of problems with that, Teresa.
Yes.
Teresa, you can take a swing at some of those problems.
So, yeah, Medicaid is very aware that people will try to do that, right? We'll say, oh, like, if they don't qualify, then let me just give everything to my son or my daughter, and then now I have less than $4,000 in my resources, and now I qualify. So Medicaid has their own strategy for pushing back on that, and that's the Medicaid look-back rule. And in Missouri, it's 60 months look-back. That means the 5 years before your date of application, Medicaid will look at those 5 years and see if you've made any what we call quote-unquote uncompensated transfers, meaning that you gave away assets for less than their fair market value. And if you've made any of these uncompensated transfers within 5 years before your date of application, then you are subject to a penalty period after you apply for Medicaid. So that means there's going to be a period for which you cannot receive the benefits until that period is over.
And now for those, though, who come in and there's no clouds on the horizon, say that our client will come in who's 75 years old even, or 70 or older, and they don't have any diagnosis. They have no reason to believe that they can't make it 60 months from a date that they do a transfer. So this is an example of one of those things among many that we'll consider as strategies to accomplish the client's goal. So for people who fit in this category, then we will develop devices by which they can do that. They will do a transfer, and it'll be predicated on the notion that they can make it to 60 months. But that never, never includes simply transferring the title to somebody else. There are so many problems with that. As a former divorce lawyer, I can tell you that that asset that you transfer to your daughter or your son is likely to become caught up in any sort of problems in their marriage.
Yeah.
And a judge is likely to be awarding part of that to perhaps somebody that you'd much rather not have that asset.
That ex-son or daughter-in-law.
Not to mention the tax implications, because that's actually owned by that other person. So who's going to pay any taxes associated with the asset?
Right.
What about debts, claimants, bankruptcy, bad decisions on the part of the husband or wife of, you know, the spouse of your child? Let's assume your child has perfect judgment, which, of course, we all know you do. But well, let's assume that. Then it's the spouse we have to worry about. But the point is, so many things can go wrong. Simply also the child making a decision that'd be harmless to use that in some way, or to pledge it as security for a loan, a business loan. The bottom line is, with lawyers, we almost never say never, but the closest I would come to saying never would be on this subject, is simply transferring an asset into somebody else's name entirely as a solution to this problem. There are much better ways for your elder lawyer to plan and do this.
Yeah, absolutely. So the tool that we use in estate planning for people who want to protect these assets while still remaining eligible for Medicaid, which is essentially the largest provider of long-term care. And the tool we use is what we call irrevocable trusts. The idea of an irrevocable trust is that you are putting these assets in this, I kind of think of a trust as a legal basket. So you're putting it into this legal basket. And if it's irrevocable, you are losing ownership of that property, but you can still retain a lot of control. I think there's a lot of misconception about irrevocable trusts being losing control, because if you think about it, if you just gift it away to like your son or daughter, that's a lot less control than
if you
did.
That's the ultimate loss of control.
Yeah, then irrevocable trust in that way, under those circumstances, is actually trying to gain back some control, setting rules for what should happen to those assets in this irrevocable trust basket.
Yeah, so it's a marvelous tool. Mm-hmm.
You can put your house in this irrevocable trust, but still live in it.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, you can do the things with your house you are otherwise doing. You know, you're living in it, coming and going, and you still can even sell your house. You want to do it through the trustee. So there are some rules you have to follow. I want to be careful that we're not too dismissive.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So having an irrevocable trust does mean you follow a few rules. And you cannot simply do with assets willy-nilly. So with the house, if you decide you want the house to be sold and to buy a new house, that can all be done by the trust. The trust would sell that house. The trust would buy you a new house. And so you would continue living in it as you otherwise would.
So who's the trust? Whoever you appoint?
The trustee of the irrevocable trust. So yeah, in a regular revocable trust, that's where you can kind of handle the assets willy-nilly.
Right.
Whereas in the irrevocable trust, normally you and your spouse cannot serve as the trustee of the irrevocable trust. But you get to appoint somebody that you trust
So a child?
Yeah, you can appoint your child, you can appoint a sibling, whoever you feel like will still have your best interests at heart and will help you manage these resources that you put into the irrevocable trust, and they can sell the house and buy a new house for you to live in. So,
and the nice thing about it is that you have, it's true that you have some rules to live by, but the good news is there are rules that give you peace of mind. It's not transferring the asset to somebody such as a family member in order to qualify for Medicaid, which incidentally 5 years have to go by. So it's not as if you transfer it to them for a month and then say transfer it back. I mean, this has to be a real transfer, number one. And number two, it's going to be for a long period of time. So all those examples we talked about a while ago of things that can go wrong, over 5 years, a lot of those things will go wrong, I can tell you from experience. So instead you have this basket, as Teresa puts it, And this basket is very stable. It has rules. And though you may have that same son or daughter, might be a trustee, they're subject to a lot of rules, and it's not theirs. That asset does not belong to them. It belongs to the trust, and there are rules about who the beneficiaries are. So in a way, while, yeah, the you might say the disadvantage is I can't do anything I want when I want it as I could because I have to follow these, I have to jump through these hoops, still, that's also good news because people at that stage in their life, they don't want things floating around in a chaotic situation. Mm-hmm. They want their assets to be governed by rules and structure. It gives them peace of mind, and it also allows them to qualify for Medicaid.
Well, now, do they have to get permission from the trustee to sell their house?
I mean, yes, right? That's why you have to appoint a trustee.
Technically,
but you can be like beneficiaries, like income beneficiaries. That's getting really ticky-tacky, but there's different types of beneficiaries in a trust. So you can be a certain form of beneficiary, and that trustee has a duty to do right by you, too, when they manage those assets.
Now, this five-year period, does that apply to irrevocable trusts? So say I create one today, and 6 months from now, I become medically incapacitated.
So yeah, the transfer into the irrevocable trust, think of that as just like one of those uncompensated transfers that Medicaid would see it as. So yeah, it would count as something like if you, that's why we would want you to plan ahead as much as possible and say, you know what, like I am getting older and I think that like long-term care will be a concern of mine later on. Then you can transfer things into irrevocable trust. And every time you transfer, that starts a five-year ticking clock for that amount.
For that particular asset.
Yeah, for that particular asset.
So the answer to your question is, yeah, if you put it in and something catastrophic happens in 6 months, it's not disastrous. We just shift gears into a different strategy. Mm-hmm. So you're right. In that case, you were hoping for the 5 years. You had reason to believe you'd get there, but you didn't. It's not catastrophic if you don't get there. But as a matter of fact, if you get close to it, if you get like 3 or 4 years, then you still want to follow that strategy. We just wouldn't make application for Medicaid until you got to the 5 years because that's when the look back gets. So if you get close, you know, say 48 months have gone by and then something happens and you have expense, well, we would pay it out of your pocket for 12 months. Mm-hmm. So for 12 months, you do what otherwise you'd be doing the rest of your life.
The nursing care facility.
Whatever those costs are, the nursing care facility, yes. So after the 12 months goes by, then you make application because then you can say, 60 months have gone by. So now you're eligible. So it's a good strategy whether you make it the 60 months or not. But we mention that because that's a handy option to consider on the menu of things that an elder lawyer would look at in order, in your specific case, to find the strategy best for you. So let's talk about a situation where somebody comes in and they've had this diagnosis, or maybe they have dementia, or they're often when we see this, maybe a husband and wife will come in, and I'm going to pick on guys here. Often it may be the guy who's having some problems with memory. Maybe it's been diagnosed as Alzheimer's. Maybe it hasn't. But the point is they see this downward sloping curve.
Right.
And they have full reason to expect that there may be in the next 2, 3, 4 years, there may be a need to go in long-term care. So for them, the conversation would probably not be suggesting the strategy we just suggested. We'd talk about some other things, and that can include a variety of options. Without going into detail explaining this one, which is sometimes called a half loaf, or it's a strategy where you by a series of transfers, you can save half of your assets. So in other words, in that case, if you had $1 million, well, we could do this transfer and probably save 500 of it. That would end up being protected in a trust. Another would be what we call a spend down. You can explain a little of that, Teresa.
Yeah. Well, so if somebody were to come in, then they would need to qualify for a Medicaid sooner than the 5 months. I think the first thing to do is to—
5 years, incidentally.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. 5 years. Yeah. The first thing to do would be first look at what are the exempt resources, right? Because normally, like, your home, that, like what we talked about, that is an exempt resource. So we can immediately knock down the value of the assets, the total value of the assets, and then just look at the remaining countable assets that Medicaid would look at. And then at that point, you can that might be enough for you to spend down to meet the Medicaid limit. Spending down, that can mean, like, if you have a lot of medical, like, at that point, you might have a lot of medical expenses, right? And medical expenses is a way to spend down to that amount where they won't count that money or that resource as a countable resource because you're dedicating it towards your medical care.
And you have to already have paid those medical bills?
Even if it's ongoing, like ongoing medical bills, saying every month I'm paying like $300 or like $1,000 in medical bills, then that means you get an extra $1,000 like buffer in terms of that spend down. So you can say, oh, I'm technically spending down because I don't actually have that many resources because a lot of my resources are actually going towards my medical.
So you can have a little bit more in the bank.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because it's going to be earmarked for those medical expenses. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And because there is a little more uncertainty with the home, as we explained a while ago, mm-hmm. the home, you're allowed to have it not count against you. So if you have even a $500,000 home or more, you can have that set aside and not considered for purposes of your qualification. Now, and this assumes that there is either the potential you'll return back to the home, which that can often be argued, at least for a while. Mm-hmm. And then there's also maybe a spouse that will continue living in the home and in a few other scenarios, a dependent child, et cetera. So in that case, sometimes just as a last-ditch effort, what we will do is if we can pour money into improvements into the house, if you can justify spending money on a house that increases its value, that's an option. Where there are so many different avenues that we can talk about here that it's difficult to cover them in the show. We want to give people an idea, though, of the possibilities so that they're encouraged to pursue this if they think that they want to rely on some third party for long-term care costs as they get older, which the vast majority of people cannot self-fund that. And almost all of them don't want to spend their last nickel or all the way down to $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 in order to have this paid. But now on this strategy though, with pouring more value into the home, it still is betting it's a marvelous strategy in the short term at least, and maybe in the long term. We've definitely qualified them without having them dissipate all their assets. And this asset, depending on what happens with the surviving spouse, if the surviving spouse is living in it for a period of time, and then maybe transfers it at their death through a will to a third party. It gets a little murky there. There's not a question about whether or not the state has the authority to go after that asset. They do. But I can tell you as a practical matter, the follow-up with surviving spouses gets a little more hazy. So that's not my go-to number one strategy, is to pour all the money into the house and hope that somehow the rules change over the next 10, 20, 30 years or other things development. But it is kind of a last resort that does protect your assets and allow you to qualify for long-term care.
Right, exactly. And honestly, for people in those situations, they're coming in for this crisis planning, and their priority really is gaining access to that long-term care coverage, because that will be a larger drain than even just like mm-hmm. whatever you are giving up in terms of how much you can save on the front. So.
Yeah. Another example would also be there are certain what are called qualified annuities. Now, these are not just any annuity. So people listening should not go out and just buy an annuity thinking this will mean that asset comes off their balance sheet. But for annuities that meet certain criteria that have been spelled out in detail after much litigation, I should say. I think this went all the way to the Supreme Court of Missouri for them to decide exactly to what extent could an annuity be an obstacle to someone qualifying for long-term care.
Right.
And it was decided that if they meet certain criteria, that they won't be. And here's how this works so powerfully is you have a husband and wife that you wouldn't be interested in this annuity if I don't. No, you would not be interested if it's just you, if you don't have a surviving spouse.
Yeah.
Its power is when you do have a surviving spouse, which most of our clients, you know, when they come in, it's husband and wife, and they're concerned primarily about one of them. So in that case, they could take, call it $300,000 and buy an annuity. And the beneficiary of the annuity will end up being the spouse that's not in the institution. So it's paying out a ton of money, perhaps, to this other spouse. You have to be careful about the payout, because when it gets $2,000, then there's enough money coming out that would be assigned to the person going in to the long-term care that they wouldn't need it. In other words, it's not that they're not qualified for long-term care. It's true they have no assets, because once you spend $500,000 on an annuity, you don't have $500,000 anymore. Mm-hmm. You have a stream of income. So now the income is the issue. And the nice thing about Missouri is there's no level of income in which you're not qualified for Medicaid. It's funny how that works. Missouri's in a minority of states as to how this is calculated. So instead, the question is, do you need the Medicaid? So they're saying, look, we're not saying to you, person who has $10,000 a month coming in from your annuity, because you bought this annuity and it's paying out a lot of money. It's throwing, that's what annuities do. They throw out income. So that person's getting $10,000 a month, we'll say. So Medicaid is not saying, look, in Missouri, you don't qualify because you're getting too much money. Instead, they would say, you could have Medicaid, and Medicaid stands ready to fill the gap between your available funds on a monthly basis and what it's going to cost you to live in this institution. And guess what? It turns out you don't need our help because you have $10,000 a month coming in, for example.
Right.
So the whole idea is to have that income assigned to the other spouse.
Right. Oh, okay.
And it has to be handled correctly. Again, this is a very technical area.
Yeah.
So it's I keep emphasizing this in this show, because I want people to understand that you've got to go to an elder lawyer. And Tucker Allen does this, but there are others in town, in fairness. So, but don't just go into a lawyer's office, even an estate planning lawyer. In fairness, estate planning lawyers know a lot, and there's a lot for them to know because all of their tax issues now, especially for wealthy estate planners. So there's so much for them to know that's very, it's often very difficult for some of those who do the most complex estate planning, quote unquote, for the rich. It's true that they know a lot, but I guarantee you, most of those are clueless about elder law planning. Mm-hmm. It never comes across their desk. Instead, they're focusing on rich people with very complex problems. And so a lot of the best, brightest people interested in planning for death, you know, and I use that phrase to capture elder law as well as estate planning, that a lot of them gravitate into estate planning because they're dealing with, you know, these multi-million dollar estates. And the other segment of the people who are willing to deal with very technical issues in such planning go into elder law, because it's equally complex, except you have the opposite clients.
Yeah.
You have middle class or lower middle class clients rather than rich clients.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating area, but these rules we're talking about now are challenging.
Yeah. It's very ticky-tacky. And then the one you're just talking about, getting the Medicaid-compliant annuities, that's one of the what we call like asset-to-income strategies, right? Converting assets, resources that you have, to income. Because honestly, if you're the institutionalized spouse, you're in the nursing home, you don't really need that income. It's your spouse that needs it. And then you want to preserve that for your loved ones. And then so that's a way of converting your assets to benefit your spouse.
And if you're just joining us, we are speaking with Teresa Yao of Tucker Allen. Now, Teresa, I want to throw out a scenario to you. So say you have a client that owns a business. Maybe it's just a small mom and pop business. Can they put that in an irrevocable trust to protect that asset from Medicaid, or would Medicaid go after that asset?
So, yeah, actually, there's nothing stopping them from titling the business into the irrevocable trust. In terms of Medicaid accessing that business asset, the business itself, if it generates enough revenue, like it's very like ticky-tacky rules, but the business can be exempted, but the income would still count as your income.
Okay.
So. Yeah. It's businesses are complicated, and everyone is different, meaning some are sole proprietors, and it's not clear what assets are technically business and technically not. Others, though, are very formalized. But here's the position of Medicaid. They want the what's called the non-institutional spouse, the spouse that that is not using the services. They want that person to not be impoverished. In fact, a specific statute was passed in, I think, 1988 that was intended to assure that these spouses were not, in fact, going to be impoverished by rules that a business is a good example. Before that was passed, a business was considered an asset. So that meant that effectively the other spouse would lose their means of survival in order so that their wife or husband can go into this institution. So that the spouse would literally be on the streets. So they changed those rules. And some things like a business, if it is truly a assets that are generating an income in the form of a business,
right.
Real estate's not considered that. At least that's a the most recent ruling I know of is that an individual piece of real estate, even though it's a rental property, is not going to get this sort of protection. But anyway, so regarding the business. So the rules want to assure that that spouse that's still in the community has a way to survive. It will count the income. So the income counts. But the value of the business itself, and again, this is a generalization
right.
for this show, but generally that would not count against that spouse going into the institution, but the income is counted.
Okay. So what can happen if you don't have this irrevocable trust with Medicaid?
I mean, I think this is where, like, if you don't have it and you can't access Medicaid, then you just either pay out of pocket for all the long-term care costs, which eventually you can't really predict how long you'll be in long-term care normally. So that might just drain all the wealth that you kind of accumulated over your lifetime. Or you could pay for long-term care insurance. That in itself is not a cheap expense anyways.
Yeah.
So really, like, for a lot of people, their hands financially would be tied.
It would mean they'd have to find $10,000, the alternative to Medicaid. If depending on what the cost is of the institution, and we'll assume that the cost will continue to rise as everything else has, maybe at a greater rate, actually,
right.
based on the cost of medical technology. So we'll assume $10,000 to $12,000 a month, and they're going to literally have to find that in cash every month to pay until they're broke.
And then they qualify for Medicaid because they don't have
those assets anymore.
Yeah, that's plan A. Really, for most people, if they don't do this sort of planning, plan A is you start selling stuff and coming up with $10,000 to $12,000 a month and soon to be much more. In some markets right now, it's $15,000 a month. St. Louis is not as high as some cities, but it's an alternative that many people just can't bring themselves to come to terms with. And we don't know how long that will be. We know that nursing home stays have been increasing over time. Because we now have the ability to keep people alive longer.
Right. People are living longer.
And people, quite frankly, are a little more willing, believe it or not, to go into these institutions because they become very nice.
I know. I mean, the competition for nice nursing homes is crazy right now.
Yeah. That's right. And when I was in Florida, and I've told this story to a few people, that I've looked at these places and I said to my wife, I said, you know, this doesn't look like a bad outcome if you end up spending the rest of your life in some of these facilities.
They look like a resort.
They're very nice.
Yeah.
And so I think that a lot of changes in the industry have required them to offer better food, better facilities, better environments, more recreation. And I know for skilled nursing centers facilities, of course, there are limitations because of the medical needs. But even there, that the same thing. So I think that the idea of people having to liquidate all they have, and often at losses. I mean, when that bill starts running, and assume that the money you're going to use to pay this is in a lot that you may own or a house, you've got to sell it. And that means that you can't wait to get the best possible price. So these are just scenarios where people who've had it happen to them, people they know, then they're motivated. They come into our office and they say, look, let's go ahead and create this irrevocable trust. I won't put all my assets in it now. Often, would you say, Teresa, probably fewer than half would put all their assets in that trust?
Yeah, so every time we create an irrevocable trust for a client, we pair it with a revocable because it's very scary to a lot of people to put everything they have into this basket where they just lose control. So you can put however much you want into the irrevocable trust, but then you can still retain a lot of control in your revocable trust. And then you can make those transfers into the irrevocable trust as time goes on. And if you kind of see, oh, I might, like, you're more sure that long-term care is kind of in your picture in the future, then you can transfer more from your revocable into your irrevocable.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense, and that keeps things balanced.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people will choose to keep income coming out of their trust to them personally, and that can be arranged.
Yes.
where the spouse that's not in the institution, we'll call them a community spouse. So the spouse who is not institutionalized or in this facility, they will need income, and so they can still continue to get income that is put in this trust. One thing, Teresa, we should mention is another planning opportunity that is really cool is that depending on when people come in, there's a point where there's a division of assets between the husband and wife, between the person who they think will need long-term care and the spouse. And depending on how that is timed, we can push a lot of assets into the name or end up, in effect, putting a lot more assets in the one spouse mm-hmm. for the one spouse than the other. Because remember, these anti-impoverishment rules, mm-hmm. they've made really clear that so many assets get to be set aside for the spouse that's not going to be in this facility. So if it's handled correctly, you can maximize those assets that get to go in the name of the person living in the community. The quote-unquote community spouse.
Sure. Yeah.
So that I don't want to fail to mention that because all of that is accomplished by getting in early enough and before it's the last minute. And that's when you can do that sort of planning.
Yeah, so definitely because there is that community spouse, the community spouse is entitled to a greater amount of resources than obviously the spouse that's going into the care facility. So in Missouri, how they calculate that is in total, what's your total countable assets between the wife and the husband? And then you take the total countable assets and you divide it by two. And then that amount, the spouse can actually keep. I mean, in Missouri, there's a certain range for that resource mm-hmm. allowance, but I think it goes all the way up until like almost $120,000.
Yeah, $120,000,
$130,000. Yeah, for the community spouse to be able to keep in resources while you're still able to qualify for Medicaid.
So say you have, okay, a married couple, older married couple. Does that, when you create this type of trust, mm-hmm. does it apply for both of them or just one of them?
I mean, so it is applying for both of them in that for a lot of times with Medicaid, a spouse's resources are counted against the institutionalized spouse. And then so for the irrevocable trust, most things are held jointly. And then so you kind of put it into the irrevocable trust and both the husband and the wife are income beneficiaries on the irrevocable trust. But under Medicaid, all that is to say is you can still reserve quite a bit of resources outside just like, but it has to stay within the limits of that allowable
okay.
resource for the spouse.
So once both of the spouses pass away, then the trustee is responsible for distributing those assets to the beneficiaries, correct?
Yeah, that's a good question because that's one of the coolest features. One of the coolest features about this sort of planning is that the assets will never go through probate. Mm-hmm. So whatever's left, the person you've chosen is your trustee, and you can choose a successor trustee so that, you know, over time, it may be your surviving spouse or someone else who might have been initially a trustee, but then could be a son, daughter. So anyway, whoever you've indicated can literally, the day after your death, could distribute assets.
Right.
In other words, there's no court involved, no judges. I mean, it's quick, it's simple. That's one of the most powerful things about all trusts is they offer this. Mm-hmm. So we don't lead with that because more people are concerned about the short term. That's protecting their assets. But in the long run, this is a marvelous way to plan to get your assets from one generation to another. Wow, time has flown. All right, as it often does. So we'll take up this topic again in the future.
Yes.
There's a lot more we could say about it, and I think it's of interest to a lot of you out there, so we promise to return to it. This has been another episode of Elder Talk. Till next time, take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Tucker Ellen, providing intelligent answers for those thinking about their future with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Sponsored by Tucker Ellen, your estate
and elder law advisors. For more information, visit TuckerAllen.com. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Tucker Allen. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.